observatory. And that's planned on launching in 2019. So this thing is supposed to land on a high mountain somewhere on the moon. In the South Pole of the moon. So hopefully they can do this. They've got a contract signed with, this one's supposed to go up on the PSLV, Polar Satellite Launch Vehicle from India. And it's going to be studying the stars, so it's some kind of an observatory. And I started reading about it, and they talked about this 2-meter antenna on board. Well, I'm thinking, well, maybe it's got some kind of 2-meter antenna. And when I finally got a picture of it, they're talking about a 2-meter dish antenna that will be sitting on top of it, sending information back to Earth. So, hopefully this gets off the ground. It's launched from India. And we'll see how that does. But it's going to study the stars. It's got some kind of radio astronomy technology on board. They're involved with Canada, France, and I'm assuming us, but I can't find anything that's been NASA on it. That's pretty much it. Back to you, Dick. This is WS.
Repeater, timeout.
Turned it over, you did.
Yeah, you had already turned it over when it gave the announcement of timing out. Don't worry. What's the major motivation of this lunar South Pole landing craft of India? It's got a 2-foot diameter, a 2-meter dish. That means 6.5-foot diameter. Is that the dish that's used to send the signal back to Earth? Is that the dish that's used to do radio astronomy with, and maybe both? And is it a confirmation of their launch vehicle and their landing capability? Is it primarily a radio telescope? What is its major thrust? Is it going to be looking for a water at the South Pole? What do you, Paul? What's the main thing they want to do? WS2N, K2LI, that is.
Yeah, the main goal of the mission is to expand human understanding of the galaxy and the cosmos through observation, you know, from the moon's surface. And what the details are, I'm not really sure. I know it's got some optical and radio astronomy involved, and one of the websites I found said that, just what you said, that the antenna is going to be used for both. You know, that remains to be seen. I found this on a couple of websites. I don't usually talk about any of these things unless I find them on multiple websites. You know, I don't trust the internet. If it was a magazine or something, that's usually a little bit better, but this one, I thought it was interesting that I couldn't find anything to do with NASA. I know the Hawaii telescope is going to be somehow involved with this study, and Canada and France, so we'll have to see as time goes on, and they're talking about launching next year, so probably late next year. I think it was the year after. Wait a minute. I think it was 2019. I think I'm wrong. 2019. There it is. Back to you.
Now, if I launched a radio telescope and landed it on the equator of the moon, you've got a couple of nasty disadvantages. Number one, your high noon temperature is probably 180 degrees centigrade, way beyond the boiling water temperature. Your nighttime temperature is like minus 250 degrees centigrade, some ridiculously cold temperature. And your radio telescope is on a rotating body. The body rotates 27 times slower than the Earth. The Earth rotates 360 degrees every 24 hours, so to speak, 23 hours, 56 minutes, and 4 seconds, sidereal day. The Moon rotates 360 degrees once every something like 27 days, so you're going to rotate much slower. But still, you need gimballing motors to take out the rotation if you want to point to a fixed star. When you're at the lunar south pole or north pole, and your telescope looks straight up, you're going to have a slow rotation and polarization, but you're looking at essentially a fixed point in the sky. So let me drop it. So if you choose a crater to mount your telescope, radio telescope, at the south pole of the Moon, in that crater you're shielded from the noise coming from the Earth. The temperature is a lot more steady. The temperature might be steady, almost steady throughout the lunar day. And your telescope aimed straight up is looking at one fixed point in the sky. So therefore, you could study that point with some nice long integration periods to find out either optically or radio-wise what's in that direction. Obvious by the ultra-deep field picture done by the Hubble Space Telescope, you choose the darkest place in the sky, and you take a long enough time exposure, and you're going to see 2,600 galaxies that have never been seen before. Each galaxy is 10 to the 11th stars, and you're going to see 2,600 of them in what you think is a black chunk of sky where you think there's nothing there. It just happened to be very dim, very far away. From one point of view, space is extremely empty, meaning there's a lot of space in between all of these heavenly bodies. Let me drop it. From one point of view, space is extremely empty. From another point of view, space is extremely full, no matter what direction you aim. There's always something to look at in that direction. There's no real blank portion of the sky, so to speak. Just certain things are very, very dim. You may have heard of something called Alpha's paradox. Because there's an infinite number of directions you can look, and if you look at any direction far enough, you're always going to be looking at a star or a galaxy. So Alpha's paradox is, how come the sky is black at night? It should be white. If you look far enough in one direction, you're always going to be looking at a star or a galaxy or a planet. So why isn't the sky bright or white? And the modern day equivalent of that, these are my words, is the sky white or black? It's white. If you have a sensitive enough camera, there is some light coming from every single direction. White or black are relative words. There's some amount of light coming from every single direction you can look. It may be very dim, but it's there. So the modern day equivalent of that, Alpha's paradox, is there almost is no paradox. Over to you for any comments on that one, Paul. WS2N, KQLIW.
Yes, I've heard that before. But I haven't heard anybody say it's white, but just don't have enough photon gathering capabilities in your eyes to see it. If you were in the darkest part of the ocean, right? I mean, there's light up there, but you're not going to see it. If you're deep enough, you're not going to see that light. About this mission, by the way, they have a mountain that they're going to actually land this thing on. They know it's a 3.1 mile tall peak. Atkin Basin, and they have the mountain, Malapert Mountain, to plan on landing this and leaving it there. Apparently, it's on near the South Pole, so that's going to help. But they are developing it to last through the night, whatever nitron they have to survive it. They're also making it repairable because they think in the future human astronauts will be able to come down and work on this thing and keep it operating. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I just did a quick calculation. You aim your telescope at something in the sky because the Earth is continuously rotating roughly 360 degrees every 24-hour day. You could say that, to round out the numbers a little bit, the telescope is being swept in azimuth, in longitude, so to speak. It's being swept 15 degrees per hour. On the moon, which rotates so much more slowly, the telescope is being swept 13.3 degrees per day. So Earth is 15 degrees per hour, moon 13.3 degrees per day, so it's a much slower speed. And so, if you don't have a motor on your telescope, when you put a star in the middle of your eyepiece, you watch the star drift across your eyepiece in minutes. You do the same experiment on the moon, and the star will drift across your eyepiece, but it's going to take hours to happen instead of minutes. So there are certain situations where that's an advantage. You can stare in some particular direction a lot easier, a lot less motor motion required with your radio telescope or your optical telescope when it's mounted on the moon. So they're not choosing a valley, they're choosing a mountain at the South Pole. What's your guess as to why they chose a mountain at Pole? Go ahead.
I think because this mountain in the South Pole will tend to be in daylight a little bit longer than if you were in a valley or in a crater.
That's both good and bad. On top of that mountain, during a portion of that 27-day lunar day, the sun is coming from the north, another part of the month, the sun is coming from the east, the south, the west, and so on. So you're not going to really be on the peak of the mountain. You're going to be on the side of it, so to speak. Whereas if you're down in the valley, it's going to be nice and dark, and the temperature is going to be almost constant. So if you intend to do some serious optical astronomy, the valley might be a slightly better place. Let me drop. And by the way, in that case of the Alper's paradox, is the sky white, gray, or black? From one point of view, with a sensitive enough camera, it's white. You can now buy I think it's a Nikon camera, where the photo detecting the charge couple, the focal plane array, has got pixels that are so sensitive that if you crank it up all the way, you can get to ASA 250,000. Is it 25,000 or 250? I think it's 250,000 ASA. The camera is so sensitive. You can probably take a picture with the lens cap on, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, that's amazing. I did find a picture now as I was looking for this thing. It shows Earth and a horizon signals going back to the spacecraft on top of the mountain. It shows it looking for stars, you know, toward its, more toward its zenith point, looking up, and then looking up the stars, again in another horizon, but, you know, away from this Earth, and the sun smack in the middle of everything, so you can see the sun lit, lighting up the one side of Earth. So I guess they're showing that this thing is going to be kind of like on the Terminator. So maybe they're just going to use the opportunity of when it's in darkness to do optical viewing, and then radio telescope, they'll be able to pretty much do it at any time. So maybe this is a proof of concept mission too. If it works out, they'll send a bigger one. Who knows? They don't say that.
Yeah, I kind of hope the Indian government is not yet talking about colonizing the moon. From time to time, the United States talks about colonizing the moon. I think that's an awful long way off. The temperature extreme you get between high noon and midnight on the moon is so extreme that I don't think there's an air conditioning system in the world that can handle that. Those astronauts had to land at a very specific point on the moon at a very specific time during the lunar month. Had to be overheated or underheated. And they couldn't stay there very long. A couple of days. It's either getting too warm or too cold, depending on whether you landed at a place that's near sunrise or sunset on the moon. Ridiculous temperature. Let me drop this. Something else I was going to mention.
One other thing about the landing time.
Go ahead about the landing.
You know, we always said that, yeah, it was always like early morning as far as the moon is concerned. But it was a little later than that. They didn't want it too early. I read not too long ago that they would have had longer shadows from everything. Craters, boulders, and they wouldn't be able to tell. It's so hard to tell how deep each little crater is, or each, you know, each little crevasse or anything that you have. There's no air there on the moon, so there's no like light reflection. So there's practically no cameras, especially back in the 70s. There's no cameras that were sensitive enough to look into these dark areas. Know how deep anything was that they were worried about. Naturally, the landing and eventually, you know, walking around on the moon. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, the article you read, Paul, may have talked about whether or not the shadows are too long or too short. You want to land on a certain part of the moon. In my opinion, that's a minor detail and it's wrong. If you landed at a place where the shadows are too long, temperature at that place might be 0 degrees centigrade, and your spacesuit may not give you enough protection. Or if you land at a place where the shadows are very short, then you're going to be at a place where the local temperature is 100 degrees centigrade. So temperature is a much bigger determining factor, because the amount of cooling and heating you've got in that spacesuit is very limited. Now, one other crazy calculation I did this week. What happens if you look straight at the sun? Why is it so dangerous? When your sun is shining on the Earth at high noon, the sun is giving you 1,300 watts per square meter. That's a lot of solar power. That's a lot of light. Let me drop this. And if you look at the sun directly, I'm not sure, but I'm going to guess your iris of your eye closes down to about a millimeter or maybe half a millimeter, the smallest it can get, to let in as little light as possible. But it can't go completely shut. There's still light coming through. So 1,300 watts per square meter is, everything down, divided by 10,000, the 10,000 square centimeters per square meter, 1,300 watts divided by exponential 4. Yeah, it's 130 milliwatts per square centimeter, which is interesting. It's very close to the original number we had for maximum permitted exposure for microwave radiation. They thought the human eye could tolerate 100 milliwatts per square centimeter. The sun gives you 130 milliwatts per square centimeter. But the lens of your eye is going to take that solar picture, the sun is half a degree wide, and because the lens of your eye is something like half a centimeter from the retina, I don't know the exact number, but it's in that ballpark, the image of the sun, if your eye is properly focusing that sun onto your retina, the image on your retina is something like 63 micrometers across. You calculate the amount of watts of power and the amount of very small area of the retina being hit with that small amount of power. The watts per square centimeter is a huge number. You're right at the threshold of burning a hole in your retina. You're certainly overheating that area. It's beyond the thermal cooling capability, and it's going to do damage. So, you go through the numbers. There's some real good reason why you want to use...
Repeater, time out.
There's some real good reason why you want to use eye protection and not look at the sun directly. And not just use welding goggles or welding hood. There are people who are afraid that even though it may almost make the sun dim enough, there's no guarantee that it's taking out enough of the ultraviolet, enough of the infrared. An awful lot of welding has got a lot of ultraviolet, but it doesn't have very much infrared, so... a welding mask might not be solar safe. Whereas the material that is made for direct solar observation, as long as it's properly rated, it will take out infrared and so on. The filter you put in front of your telescope to look at the sun, white light observing, has a filter factor of 10,000 to 1. 10 to the 4th power. So that's 0.01%. Let me think about that. 0.1% is 1,000 to 1. 0.001% of the solar energy comes through.
That's what APG with the question.
Go ahead, Dave.
That's what APG. Quick question, what do you think? I was always brought up that you never use an instrument to look at the sun directly, that you would use the projection method to view the sun, because that's the safest method. Is there an advantage to using these solar filters and things like that to, you know, directly observe the sun? I mean, from my point of view, the risk versus reward benefit seems kind of dangerous, you know?
The safest kind of solar observing, which is not exciting, is a pinhole camera. You've got an opaque piece of paper with a small pinhole, and you're projecting it onto a white piece of paper that's inside of a box. That's the safest, but it's not very exciting to look at. The next safest, that's almost safe, that people have used is binocular projection. A pair of binoculars aimed at the sun, and what comes out of the eyepiece gets projected onto a white piece of paper. That's almost safe. You take your full-size telescope with a good eyepiece, and you think you're going to project that onto a white piece of paper. You're going to get a much bigger, much brighter picture. That's the good news. The bad news is a high probability you have just destroyed your eyepiece. The total amount of illumination of a 6-inch or an 8-inch telescope, the total number of watts of solar power it can gather, when all of that is focused down to an eyepiece, it will cook the glue that's holding the individual elements of your eyepiece together, and it will probably permanently damage your eyepiece. Let me drop it. And you also better put a piece of tinfoil in front of your viewfinder, because the solar energy coming in the front end of your viewfinder on your telescope is going to take that crosshair and burn it out. The crosshair is really two little pieces of spider web in there at right angles, and it's going to burn that out. So the total amount of energy coming through a telescope, unless you're using if it's a Newtonian telescope and you're using a Herschel wedge, a Newtonian telescope, that's the one where you've got the 45-degree mirror. If you take out the 45-degree mirror and substitute it with a pure, clean, clear piece of glass, optically flat glass, because 99% of the energy goes through the glass and only a little bit reflects from the surface, now, with that Herschel wedge, the amount of energy getting into your eyepiece is safe. And you can put your human eye at that eyepiece with a Herschel wedge. but your main mirror down at the bottom, it can tolerate the solar power. But that energy coming out of that main mirror, after it hits your 45-degree mirror, it ain't safe anymore. So even with projection schemes, as I see it, Dave, you got to be careful. And therefore, the right kind of a filter in front of your binoculars, or the right kind of a filter in front of your telescope, without the Herschel wedge, that is the safest way. And 2APG, K2LAW.
Okay, I remember years ago when I had my Newtonian 6-inch reflector. I remember using the projection method, and I don't, you know, it was like almost 50 years ago, 40, whatever, 50 years ago. I don't remember if I was using an eyepiece or not. Is it possible to use a Newtonian without an eyepiece and get a projection image of the sun?
Absolutely. But I think it's a very long projection. And let me think about that. You get a better picture with the eyepiece. Now, the old-fashioned eyepieces didn't have anywhere near as many elements, and they weren't glued together. There was air spaces in between. If the elements in your eyepiece are thoroughly separated with air spaces in between, and it's a 6-inch telescope or a 4.5-inch telescope, I think the total amount of solar energy there can be tolerated. The modern day colossal that glue cannot tolerate solar energy at that eyepiece. I think there's a good chance you could damage a modern day eyepiece, Dave. And 2APG, K2LAW.
Yeah, that makes sense. You might do that. Just a caveat too. I you know, there's been a lot of coverage about the you know, the inexpensive glasses that you can buy. You know, the cardboard type glasses that you can use to view the eclipse. And there's been some controversy about, you know, the ones that are approved by NASA, et cetera, and the ones that are being sold online. Perhaps are not exactly the same quality. So again, you know, you got to be careful. You don't want to lose your eyesight over this.
Yep. And maybe they're being ultra conservative, but if it doesn't have the right NASA rating or American Astronomical Association rating, the energy that might be coming through that or the ultraviolet region, which your eye does not respond to, therefore you don't know it's there, but it could be cooking your eye. I remember the experiment I did once, which was very foolish. I remember taking a number 89 filter, I think it's 89. It's the infrared filter if you want to take infrared pictures with a 35mm camera. I remember holding that in front of my eye and looking at the sun, thinking that I would dimly see the sun. I hope I didn't do that very long, because the total amount of infrared energy coming through that filter could have been significant. So, you gotta be careful. It's awful easy to damage an eye. And the better your eye can focus, the sharper the image will be, the smaller will be the diameter of the image at your retina, therefore being a sharper filter, sharper focus, and smaller, same amount of energy over a smaller area is more capable of doing damage, burning a hole, if you know what I mean. You're almost better off if your eye doesn't properly focus, but in either case, don't look at the sun. Let me drop this. What amazes me is in my youth, I heard stories about an Indian tribe that would prove to their manhood that they could stare at the sun for a long period of time. I remember hearing stories along those lines. And boy, that doesn't seem reasonable. I wonder if you've ever heard of stories like that, Dave. N2APG, K2RIW.
Not at all. Nope. But I guess they were some rugged Indians, huh?
Dick, did you ever hear about the negatives and cameras years ago?
Yes. In the late 40s, I remember the newspaper was telling you to take a whole bunch of 16-20 negatives from your pictures, stack them together until it was dark enough and look at the sun. And they're not sure that that's safe. Yes, you can make the solar image dim enough by doing that, but is it really filtering out all the infrared? There's some doubt on that. Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
I agree, but I do remember that, but any of the young people today would say, what's a negative? Dick, when you get a chance, why, you can look at the sun now, but yet during the eclipse, it's going to be dark. We're not here, but dark. And it's only going to be the corona that you're looking at. Why is that more dangerous than looking at the sun, at 12 o'clock on any other day? That's my comment on that. Back to you.
Yeah, okay. Eric first. KE2EJ, go ahead, Eric.
I just wanted to point out, for the Hessel way, you really don't ever want to use one that's designed for solar viewing with a reflector, because your secondary layer is really close to your focal plane. And all that extra IR that you're getting is contained patterns, as you said, to melt or crack the elements of it. Multi-lens eyepiece, but with a refractor, it's not as much of an issue. Lens are really designed for solar viewing. Not only have the spiritual density filters in it, but the prism itself also doesn't have infrared ultraviolet. And the output size that gets rid of the excess energy is really important.
These personal solar telescopes, I can't think of the brand name right now. What's the brand name of that thing that's being sold? And the filter is being manufactured. The filter that does all that work is being manufactured right here on Long Island. Lundy. The Lundy personal solar telescope. They've got a very good filter up front that makes that thing safe. A Herschel wedge is really a clear piece of glass that's got an optical flat on it. And 99.99% of the energy focused by your main mirror hits the Herschel wedge, which is at a 45-degree angle, a clear piece of glass. And 99.999% of the energy goes right through the glass. You've got to make sure you don't put your eye out there. And only a very small percentage reflects off the optical flat at a 90-degree angle off into the eyepiece. So I think a Herschel wedge on a 6-inch Newtonian is safe to do solar white light observing. At least I've done that in the past, and I think it's safe. Thank you for comment on that, Paul. Eric, KE2EJ, K2RIW.
No, it's been my experience of using this way. One of the things that's written in the instructions for the device is that don't use it on an Newtonian type telescope, simply because the focal plane gets to be too close because of the secondary mirror that you have there. And don't forget, with the reflector, the image is still not at the focal plane on the 90-degree mirror that's going to point you off towards your eyepiece. That's getting really close to where the focal point of the image is. With a refractor, you have all that additional glass. They say that the glass of the refractor doesn't really absorb any of the energy that it passes right through. But where you're putting the Herschel wedge is still somewhat out of the focal plane, and that's why the tube that the prism is reflecting towards is a long way off compared to a Newtonian. But we in my experience, and by the way, the Herschel wave with the refractor doesn't work very well, but for the Newtonian, what I do, what I'm looking for sunspots, do they say, do look at the sun now and then, they, I have a rather simplistic eyepiece. It's not an acrobat, it's not a multi-composite eyepiece. I don't really care if I crack it. But I project that onto a screen, and the distance is not that far off, and it does give you a beautiful picture.
And you said that a Herschel wedge is dangerous as a Newtonian, and you used the word Newtonian multiple times. I think you meant Cassegrain. If you use a Herschel wedge with a Cassegrain, it's dangerous, and I agree. If you use a Herschel wedge with a Newtonian, I think it's safe. Back to you on that one, Eric. KE2EJ, KQRIW.
Well, from what I've read and what I've experienced, a Cassegrain is actually worse than a Newtonian. But still, if you look at, let's say you have an 8-inch mirror at the bottom of your tube, you still have a quarter-way plate that's tilted at a 45-degree angle, so is that you get the image reflected towards the tube of the ice. The fact that that reflective mirror is rather small says that we're getting really close to the focal point. So I don't think an open wedge is good on either a Cassegrain or a Newtonian. But well, at least that's what I've learned, and that's what I've been read, and that's what I've also experienced. By the way, in terms of the welding mass, there's a series of welding filters. They have a funny number that goes from a number that's like 5 to a number that's 30, and they say that the number lasts 12 through 15 or 16 has the ability to block not only the ultraviolet but the UV, because there's different types of off-welding devices not only create UV, but they create an awful lot of infrared energy, so there is a rating system for them. I don't have it in front of me, but you can use, quote-unquote, they say, use a number 13 or 14, when you finally get to 15, it's garbage, and don't go any lower than that, so that's coming out of the back of my head, but I know there's some, I can pick up some paperwork that
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
When it comes to a 6-inch diameter Newtonian telescope, where you're taking the silvered 45-degree mirror, taking it out, and replace it with a Herschel wedge, you're not focusing at that point, Doug Paul. That Herschel wedge, because the mirror is 6 inches in diameter and the scope tube itself is about 7 inches in diameter, the center of the Herschel wedge is 3.5 inches from the perimeter of the scope. You're directing the light down the tube where the eyepiece is going to be, and you go another 2 inches down the eyepiece before the eyepiece does the focus. So 2 inches down the tube, 3.5 inches from the center, you're 5.5 inches away from focus where the Herschel wedge is. So the Herschel wedge is pretty far from focus, and therefore the watts per square meter of focal energy there is not dangerous to the focal, to the Herschel wedge. And the Herschel wedge is reflecting very little of the light at the 90 degree angle into the eyepiece. So I think lots of people have used a Herschel wedge with a 6-inch Newtonian telescope when doing solar observing. I know that that Herschel wedge for a Newtonian was a commonly purchased item 20 years ago. I don't know whether or not in the Orion catalog it's still there. Over to you, Paul, Eric, KQEJ, KQIW.
Well, I do know that there are a number of different kinds that were sold over the years. Like when I joined this in about 15, 20 years ago, something like that. The the type that you replace the reflective mirror in the Newtonian, and there is a type that you add to the eyepiece to. That has another extension on it that has its particular eyepiece with its eye also in it. So, you may be right in one case, and you may be wrong in the other case. So, what you're talking about, you're probably right. What I'm talking about, where the Herschel wedge is external to the two, I'm probably right.
Yeah, my Herschel wedge was down the tube itself. Okay, we've run out of time. This was TechNet number 1663. That was space report number 263. 73, you all. Be kind to each other. And we're looking forward to the great big memorial that will take place at 9 o'clock Friday night on this frequency. Bye-bye, you all. Over to you, Paul, for any other final comments. WS2N. Keep your eyes open clear, but listening.
Okay, very good on Friday. And we're waiting for it tomorrow afternoon, 12:31, a launch from Cape Kennedy, from Launch Complex 39A, of another Dragon cargo ship going up to the International Space Station. 12:31 p.m. 73, have a good week, and we'll be back next week on Friday at WS.
AC2GS, you still there, Dick?
Yes, I am, Roy. Go ahead.
Okay, for anyone listening who's a biblical scholar, there are 9 entries for very bad descriptions of eclipses. 5 in the Old Testament, 4 in the New. Not very good description. With it, the stars go out as well.
How about that? Where did you research that one, Roy?
Who is our friend?
Okay, I think you said Google. The first word got cut off. I was going to ask you if you looked in your concordance. I'll have to ask my biblical scholar wife whether or not she can find it in her concordance of the Bible. Bye-bye, Roy. Thank you.
Okay, very good. I'll send you the source.
Thank you, sir.
WWB2BXO.
Go ahead, Frank.
Yeah, very good. I just was wondering if you heard the comment earlier about no references to NASA in a discussion of the Indian space program. I think there's a very interesting reason for that, sir. Okay?
Go ahead and give us the reason.
If I remember correctly, I've heard a number of times that I believe the U.S. government, and I know in some cases U.S. amateurs, are unable to participate in Indian government and Indian amateur space programs, because the nation of India is technically still at war with an American ally, which is Pakistan, and of course, space technology is dual-use technology. Go ahead.
Okay, that sounds like a possible explanation.
Okay, Dick. Just thought I'd throw that in at the risk of getting into too much politics. Anyway, it is bedtime for all of us, I guess. I know it's bedtime for the repeater. WB2BXO in Philadelphia via Echo Link. And I did correct the mass location on my QRZ page.
Well done, Frank.
Oops. Nice. 7-3.
K2RWW2YY, I sent you a reply to your email earlier. Thanks.
Roger, Dodger. I'll go look for it.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the WQVL repeater.